Welcome to Onk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jason Harris. Onk Live On Air is a podcast from Onk Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onk Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In the second of a two-part series, I sat down again with Narjust Duma, MD, a physician and associate director of the Cancer Equity Program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, to talk about the unique challenges facing women with lung cancer. Although lung cancer is the second leading cancer in women and the leading cause of cancer deaths, the risks associated with the disease are often overlooked. Moreover, women make up only 39% of participants in lung cancer clinical trials, and Dr. Duma said the absence of women in these trials has major ramifications for treatment and survivorship. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Duma discussed improving diversity in trials and in oncology providers, how the oncology field fails women in general and women of color in particular, and the stress lung cancer puts on a woman's home life.
Good afternoon, Dr. Duma. Thank you for joining us again for part two of our Women in Lung Cancer podcast. Very quickly, just as a refresher, how is lung cancer different in women compared with men?
Well, there are several differences, and they range from the time of diagnosis to the moment of death. But to summarize, when remove the smoking cortin of the smoking as a risk factor, two-thirds of patients are women. In addition, women face more delays in diagnosis, but overall, they have a better overall survival compared to men.
Your own research found that only 39% of patients involved in lung cancer clinical trials are women. So how does that affect both drug development and outcomes of these clinical trials?
Well, one of the challenges about the lack of incorporation of women in clinical trials is that we are unethically extrapolating data that's for a majority white male population to treat the rest of the patients. And we're talking about 52% of the population for women. So we have learned this through our research, but the consequences are very large. We don't know if these drugs are as equally affected as women as men, because women have not been included in the trials. So should they also require a different dose? While not in oncology, but in other areas of medicine, it has been proven that dosing should be different by gender. Medication has been taken out the market to be readjusted or redosed to women. And the problem for that was because women having worse adverse events than men. And in cancer, I think hasn't been done yet because our patients unfortunately don't live that long to compare differences. But are women getting the right treatment? We don't know because we only tested in a portion of women. Is the dosing adequate for women? We don't know either. And that brings, unfortunately, ethical concerns and just practical concerns about how effective and how tolerable these drugs are in 52% of the population.
Why aren't more women included in these trials?
The big one is gender bias. So I had a patient 1 or 2 months ago, and she's a younger patient with young children in a clinical trial, and her treating oncologist told her that a clinical trial was not a good option for her because she was busy at home. And that's just an example of gender bias. It is not the physician's role to decide if a clinical trial is not right for a patient. You present options, and the patient, we select the option that works better for them. Because sometimes a clinical trial is the best treatment option. It provides patients the opportunity to get therapy combinations before they're FDA approved.
Then how can oncologists make sure that more women are included on trials?
Well, it's important that all patients with newly diagnosed lung cancer are given the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial, regardless of their gender or their race, ethnic background, or sexual orientation, or gender, because it's the right thing to do. So the first thing is that we need to be conscious that it is not our role. So all treatment options, including clinical trials, should be included or presented to all patients. One of the things that I motivate patients at oncologists to do when they're trying to meet target accruals is to be very purposely. We have the power to offer options to our patients. And understanding that all patients should have the same options is a very easy thing to do. Bring three options, no treatment. These are the standards, FDA-approved treatments, and these are the clinical trials. I always provide my patients with these three options, regardless of who they are. No treatment, we switch to best supportive care or hospice. These are the FDA-approved treatments, and these are the clinical trials. Dr. Toby Campbell from the University of Wisconsin developed a tool that he has tested to offer patients options. So there's already a diagram, there's already a way to do it that has evidence-based information of how to provide options to patients. So the answer is always more options, the better the patients can make decisions. And of course, to be very careful that we don't push a patient towards one option versus the other.
You touched on a bit just a second ago, but most patients in clinical trials are white men, which obviously has impacts on women of color. So you talked about how there's gender bias in the number of women who get recruited into trials. Do you also see racial bias in the same way?
So this is just an example of intersectionality. So intersectionality is a concept that was developed in New York City by Dr. Bradshaw that describes that humans are not the result of one experience. We're the result of all the experience secondary to multiple identities. For example, a Black man has experience, but if that Black man is also part of the LGBT community, he has the racial bias that he has to face, and he has the homophobic bias that he has to face. And unfortunately, those multiply, they don't subtract. So for a woman of color, the chances of going in a lung cancer clinical trial are the lowest because the identities intersect and they multiply the biases. So no, are only women less likely to be given the option to participate in a clinical trial, but if you're a woman of color, those probabilities are lower. And let's add a third identity. If that woman of color is also a low socioeconomic status or lives in a low-income neighborhood, that identity multiplies more. So the probabilities that these women with newly diagnosed lung cancer will be given the option to be in a clinical trial are minuscule. And is that example of intersectionality. We are the result of all our experience through our identities, not only one. And that is unfortunately when subgroups are affected the most. And we're less aware about this because there are smaller groups. So a lesbian woman of color, the groups are smaller. So we don't hear the same advocacy for these groups compared to people that have one or two identities.
Which is a little surprising. I know that there's certain genetic markers like BRAF that are much more common in women of African descent. And so you're saying even despite that, you still see minuscule numbers of women of color in these trials.
Well, let me give you an example. In 2018, I published a paper about the recruitment of minorities, particularly Black African-American patients, into multiple myeloma clinical trials. So multiple myeloma is a disease that largely affects people of color. But even in diseases that are more prevalent in people of color, they're still not being recruited to the disease that affect them. So that is my paper that showed that only less than 10 to 12% of patients in large multiple myeloma clinical trials were Black or African American. So you're trying to develop a solution for a population, but you're not including the population in the solution. So is that a real solution? Or you're just creating a solution for the majority group? So that paper really showed that even the disease, if the disease is more prevalent in minority patients, the physician bias, the system bias, discrimination and racism permeates even through that, and patients are not included in the clinical trials.
Organizations like ASCO have really made a push in the past few years to improve racial diversity in their clinical trials. Have you seen any evidence that that's working?
Well, I can tell you, based on the recent ASCO, not really. The large studies that were presented at the plenary session have minimal minor recruitment. And for a large presentation, there was even a standing ovation. And I went back to the paper, and there's around 11 to 25 women of color recruited in a study that's changing the standard of care. So you can be talking a lot about it, but we need actions. We need the patients to go on the trials. And that's the difference between an active ally and somebody who's not an ally, and it's action. Are you recruiting the patients? Show me the numbers. And people are saying, oh, you know, we changed a lot of things after the summer of 2020. And My argument against that, Jason, is that before the summer of 2020, we were still here. We were already here. Me as a Latino woman, I didn't come out and existed in the summer of 2020. So the efforts needed to happen before that. And now people are using that as an excuse for the lack of doing ethical research. And that's what it is. It's ethical research. If you don't include everyone, is that ethical? Because then you're getting a drug approved from the majority white male population. So as a doctor, it's very difficult for me sometimes to break down side effects to my patients who are like me, who ask me, so how people like me tolerated the drug? I have many patients who told me that. My women of color tell me this all the time. And I often have to say, I don't know. There's only five of us in this trial or thousands of patients. So I think we need to incorporate patients in clinical trials, and we need to understand that's the ethical thing to do. And when we graduated from medical school and we did a Hippocratic oath, you know, the oath didn't include a star that says only the majority group are we help, right? It's to everyone. And that's what we need to do. And 30% of the causes why minority patients are not going into clinical trial is physician bias.
So it really starts then, what, as early as medical school or even before that, teaching physicians and future researchers to diversify their study population?
I think as soon as somebody decides to want to do science. And one of the things that in my own lab, in the Flores lab, that we're trying to do is to get them early as possible. So this summer, we have a college student and a high school student for the first time in my lab for a summership. So we can create a big difference, you know, advocating for everybody to include minorities, but also for developing the oncology workforce, because we need people that look like our patients. So in a recent paper that I published at the Journal of Oncology Practice, which is part of the ASCO journals, showed that only 4.7% of all oncologists in the United States are Latinx or Hispanic, despite the population being 18.4% being Hispanic. And by 2030, one out of five people in the United States will self-identify as Latinx or Hispanic descent. So that's one out of five people. That's a lot of people, if you ask me. So getting early, teaching the importance of being inclusive. And I think for many of us, Jason, and I don't know if you agree with this, this is a personal matter because we have been excluded ourselves. So we develop a career journey to make sure everyone, not only racial minorities, but all marginalized groups are included.
Yeah, I was just thinking how rare this conversation is between a Black man and a Latin woman talking about oncology. There's not a lot of us in and around this field.
And that's the value, and that's what I think your points and my points are a little bit different, but they are important because I can tell you traditions sometimes is the obstacle to innovation.
We can talk about this all afternoon, but I want to get onto some other topics.
Let's get back to women with lung cancer.
Sure. So I wanted to talk a bit about survivorship, and you touched on it a second ago when you talked about how you had a young woman who was a parent, and she was discouraged from entering a clinical trial because she had young children at home, and that's not the sort of bias that a man generally faces. So women are typically tasked more with childcare, more with taking care of the home. So how does that affect a woman once she does have a diagnosis of lung cancer?
So there are several aspects with survivorship that are very different in women. And one of them you touch on, and it's the society obligations that are put on women. And COVID-19 just actually, you know, reinforced what we already knew. When the kids were at home doing remote schooling, the majority of the responsibility lay on women. Doesn't mean all households are like this, but it's the majority, and we all know that. So when a woman gets diagnosed with lung cancer, something that I have seen very unique is that, and the way in which society pushes women to delay their care before everybody else, like after everybody's taken care of. So often I see patients in my clinic that had a cough for a few months, that were losing weight, but, you know, They needed to get to soccer. They needed to care for dinner. They needed to take the dog to the bed. I have a patient that took the dog to the bed more times before she even got medical care. Because that is what you have been taught since you are born, that you are a woman, you need to take care of your family. And that pressure of the society, sometimes women neglect their own care. I have honestly seen wives that come with newly diagnosed husbands, and I'm like, I wonder if she also has lung cancer, but she's here taking care of him. So that is very unique. I often have to tell my ladies, it is okay that he doesn't make it to soccer, okay? You need your chemotherapy to stay around. Like, I say it way too often. And this is not only unique to young women, also to older women. They have, unfortunately, the responsibility of grandchildren. I have a lot of women that got COVID from the grandchildren because they were the main source of childcare. This is at the beginning of the pandemic, right? The mom needs to go to work. The kid needs to go to daycare. Grandma picks out the kid from daycare. And we all know daycare comes with cooties. We know that. So that responsibility is very large, and it's embedded in our patient's brain that anybody's health and their household is priority compared to theirs. And what happens when the woman gets sick? When the woman gets sick, a lot of hands on deck come at the beginning. And this is very unique as a survivorship in women. Grandma comes, mother-in-law comes, sisters, brothers come. But after the diagnosis is made and the patient starts chemotherapy, all those hands on deck go back to whatever they were doing. And the woman remains with the same responsibilities before diagnosis, and now the responsibilities of getting treatment and surviving the treatment. Another aspect of survivorship I think is also unique to women is they're most likely to have side effects from therapy. My own study in 2019 and our recent study published in 2022 shows that women are most likely to have side effects from chemotherapy compared to men. And this is in part because they were not included in the clinical trials, going back to the other area. So we learn about the side effect in women after the drug is approved. So women are most likely to have side effects, most likely to require dose reductions in the chemotherapy compared to men. And that is our large consequences. You know, is the drug less effective? Why is the survivorship more challenging? Because they're having more side effects compared to men. And another aspect of survivorship that we cannot forget is the mental aspect. And it can be very challenging for women with lung cancer to face a diagnosis they're not aware of. So the media continues to show that lung cancer is a disease of white old men, when in fact it's not. For the first time in 2018, the incidence of lung cancer in young patients is higher in women than men. And this is particularly unique for Hispanic women. So when a woman gets diagnosed with lung cancer, it's a big shock compared to when they get diagnosed with breast cancer. And there's a lot of mental work that needs to be done, that the only thing that you require to be diagnosed with lung cancer is to have a pair of lungs. So there's a big mental challenge. I think we talked briefly about this, but when 1,000 women were asked, what was the number cause of cancer death in women? Only 1% answered lung cancer. All the other cancers were mentioned. So there's a very big emotional shock for a woman diagnosed with lung cancer because they don't think they get it. That's not a disease that affects me. And that is very unique. And that brings depression. It brings anxiety and also brings delays in diagnosis because of the denial or the delays in treatment. I have patients that were completely in denial because lung cancer doesn't happen to women. And that delay, the visit with me, the initiation of therapy. So survivorship in women is very different from the responsibilities at home, from tolerability to therapy, to the mental aspects associated with a diagnosis of lung cancer.
Talking about home life, this is an older study, and it's in patients with brain cancer, but men were 7 times more likely to leave their wives if she was diagnosed with brain cancer. There's been research that says that men are more likely to leave their wives when they have a chronic illness. So is that something you discuss with your patients, and is that something they're worried about when they get the diagnosis?
So that's very important, and I've seen it. And I have suffered with my patients because there's nothing worse than being diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and then filing for getting divorce papers. First, the repercussions of this. Some of these women can no longer work because of the disease. So they depend on that spouse insurance to get healthcare. How inhumane is to literally strip a dying woman of healthcare? And I have seen it. I have seen it many times, probably way too many times. I don't have a number. I don't think the study has been done. And now, Jason, you're giving me ideas. So maybe in 2 years from now, we're going to talk about that. But
I want a co-author credit if that comes up.
100%. And the Flores lab, everybody is welcome to contribute. We're a very different lab. So I've seen it. And I can tell you it's heartbreaking, especially if the woman doesn't have a strong family support from her parents, because it's very isolated. And you know what is the biggest challenge, Jason? They leave, and they leave the kids behind. So the woman doesn't only have lung cancer, she also has double the responsibilities with children. And I'm not here to point fingers at one gender versus the other, but I have seen it. And my own study in 2019 shows that for over 400,000 patients with non-small cell lung cancer, if you are a male and you were married, you will live longer. But if you are a woman and you were married, there was no difference in survival. So, and my study is not the only one to show that. And it shows the importance of family support at the time of cancer diagnosis and how we need to support patients beyond CT scans, chemo, side effects, and lab work, because they're more than the disease. And I have seen patients crumble more because of the challenges with their families than the disease itself.
Again, I really appreciate you taking the time. I appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us about something I think gets overlooked a lot. Like you say, a lot of women don't realize their risk for lung cancer is so great. So thank you again.
It is my pleasure. And I think for my take-home message of this second part is, do you only need a pair of lungs or even one lung to get lung cancer? If you have smoked in the past, talk to your primary care doctor to get lung cancer screening, because lung cancer screening saves lives.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Narjust Duma, and thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.